This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we continue our trade series with a piquant look at the many faces of the spice trade. From the high price tag of saffron to the ubiquity of chilies and the potential ripple effect that farmer protests in India may have on the global spice market.
You know, farmers are protesting because they feel like their lives and livelihoods are on the line.
You find it in a lot of cured foods like cured meat and Parmesan cheese. You also find it in ripening foods, like ripe tomatoes are very high in MSG. So there's sources of it all over the natural world.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deal in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Andrew Centofonte, who is the co-owner and head brewer of North American Sake Brewery in Charlottesville, Virginia, which opened in 2018. It's Virginia's first and only sake brewery. Despite its short history, the brewery has won the silver and bronze medals at the 2020 World Sake Challenge for its classic style sake. But Andrew also makes super creative sake as well. So today we'll discuss how Andrew got into Japanese sake, challenges in opening a sake brewery in Virginia, his innovative philosophy of making sake, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, and whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And I have a quick announcement. MOFAT, or the Museum of Food and Drink, is holding a fascinating online event on Wednesday, March 10th from 8 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The event is called Miso, Shoyu, and Samurai, the Cuisine and Culture of Aichi Prefecture. Known as the home of samurais, the Aichi Prefecture is celebrated for its exquisite white soy sauce and umami-rich miso, called the Hacho Miso, among many other things. And located between Tokyo and Osaka, Aichi has a distinctive food culture. For example, if you order a cup of coffee, you will get a free set of breakfast in Nagoya, which is the capital of the prefecture, and it's called the Morning. And so during the event, there will be a cooking demo to introduce us to Aichi's unique products, and a massive braidsmith, Mary Carter, who received the title of the 17th generation Yoshimoto braidsmith in Japan, will discuss Japanese craftsmanship. Also, food writer and culinary photographer Michael Holland-Turkel and myself will have a discussion with guests from Aichi about the unique food culture. For tickets, please go to MOFAT's website. It's www.mofad.org, mofad.org/events, and click on March 10th on the calendar on the screen, and you can also order specialty ingredient box with Aichi products with your tickets before March 4th, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So hopefully I'll see you there. So now let's start a conversation with Andrew Centofonte. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So happy to be here.
I'm very honored to have you here. So first of all, we are curious who you are. So where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Yeah, so I'm from the East Coast. I was born in New Jersey, raised in North Carolina, and then eventually made my way to Virginia, where I've been now for the last probably 20 years. What did I eat when I was growing up? You know, my family has an Italian heritage, so you know, obviously we had a lot of pasta and Italian food. You know, I grew up on my grandmother's meatball and homemade pastas, and all kinds of things like that. It kind of is the base of a lot of what I still eat now.
Right. So you're one of those lucky ones to be able to eat grandmother's Italian food.
Yeah. My grandmother was an incredible chef. She would make such delicious Italian food, like roasted red peppers. And I think the thing that I always loved was when we would make homemade pasta together, you know, mixing those ingredients and then, you know, hanging the noodles on broomsticks across all over the kitchen was always a fond memory of mine.
Right. And of course, Italian food goes so well with the Japanese sake too. So
yes, it does.
Right. So it's not a coincidence that you're making sake. So how did you get into sake?
Yeah. So my journey with sake, started probably about, 10 years ago now. I was really fortunate to be working for a company called Semester at Sea, and I was able to travel the world on a ship. So Semester at Sea is a study abroad program that takes students to a number of different countries around the world, and I was able to work on the ship as a videographer. And so I was able to travel to, I think on that trip we did 14 different countries over the course of a semester. And so all along the way, I got the opportunity to explore, you know, world cuisine, all kinds of different foods and drink from, you know, South Africa to India to China. And then Japan was one of our last stops. And I really had an eye-opening experience in terms of sake when I was there. And I wish I could tell you where I was. It was somewhere in Tokyo having an incredible sushi dinner, and looking at this sake list and just thinking, you know, I'm here in Japan and I don't know much about sake, but I'm here, let's dive in. And I started to just try multiple different sakes from different breweries and different regions. And it was so mind-blowing. Just the range of flavor, the range of different styles and, just different texture that I was experiencing for the first time. It was just a revelation. And so from that point forward, it became a real hobby of mine. I came back to the US and just started seeking out different sakes and really looking for new bottles, new you know, labels that I hadn't seen before, new producers, and, you know, slowly started to kind of build my knowledge around what sake was, which is a lot of fun. I encourage everybody to do that.
Well, but back then, 10 years ago, I don't think sake was widely available as much as now, right?
Especially... Well, yeah, no, and it's still not very widely available, especially in Virginia. It was one of those things where, you know, I kind of exhausted my local supplies pretty quick of something new. But if I happened to be traveling or going to visit a friend somewhere, I'd always swing by a liquor store or a beer shop and see if they had something different. Or every time I went to a Japanese restaurant, you kind of, you know, start looking for types we hadn't tried before. And I think that's something that really opened my eyes to sake, because I drink a lot of different alcohol. I love beer, craft beer and wine and ciders. And kind of my perspective around, you know, that kind of that craft style of alcohol, for some reason, I hadn't really realized that around sake. But when I was in Japan and seeing all the different brewers and seeing all the different types and classifications, it was just kind of this moment of, oh, wow, there's a lot more to sake than I thought. And so, you know, looking for different breweries is something that I think is a lot of fun to do. And I encourage everybody to do it.
Right. Yeah. And then especially, you know, I've been based in New York for a long time and go to Japan sometimes. And the one, like, really ordinary liquor store, and you go to, you know, the sake section, there's a whole wall of it, and you get excited. It's like 10 times more, 100 times more sake, like, wow. So Yeah, it's just unlimited surprises in the world of sake. But you opened your sake brewery in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2018, but your background was marketing. So why did you decide to open your own sake brewery in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, it was a slow kind of progression. I had always done homebrew of beer, and you know, one fateful night after drinking maybe one too many bottles of sake, I was looking at it and just going, I wonder if I could make this. I wonder how it's made. And you know, that was a very fateful night, because the next morning I went out and I went to the homebrew store and they had some koji spore, and I went and got some rice, and I tried it out for the first time, making koji in my attic because it was warm, and you know, my main mash in my basement because it was cold. And you know, the first batch wasn't great looking back, but it was good enough to kind of get me hooked. And so I just started brewing a lot of sake in my basement, and my, you know, one batch turned into three, turned into five, turned into 10, 20. And then my wife was like, what are you doing? And converting the whole basement into a small sake brewery. So it became just such a passion. It was this drive to understand, because it was all, and still is, so mysterious and magical to me. And the flavors, the aromas were so unique and so different than anything that I had experienced before. And I knew that my sake, you know, I just had a lot of work to do on it. So I just wanted to keep trying and learning and trying to get better. So from there, kind of started doing bigger steps of trying to see if this is something I could do professionally, travel to different sake brewers around the U.S., and then eventually got to go over to Japan again and study under Daimon-san at Daimon Shuzo, a sixth-generation sake brewer out there.
So let me just interrupt for a second. So that sounds like you really studied sake making by trial and error first, and then eventually you interned at the Daimon Brewery in Osaka, right, to learn from the sixth generation master sake brewer. And so when was it, and how was the experience? Like, you know, give me more details.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was a lot of trial and error. You know, there aren't a lot of resources in English and readily available, you know, online. It's not like the beer community where you've got message boards and different groups and, you know, associations that are put together. So you're kind of flying blind in a lot of ways. And so I think that kind of drove this curiosity in my mind. It kind of frustrated me, and I wanted to figure it out and understand it as best I could. And so, yeah, a lot of trial and error. And then, you know, again, fate steps in funny ways. But one night I was doing some research, you know, combing through YouTube for any videos about sake making that I could find. And I stumbled upon one from Daimon Shuzo, and I went to their website and went to their contact form and just sent them an email and said, hey, you know, I'm a sake brewer. I'm an aspiring sake brewer. Like, is there any way we could connect? And the next day I got an email back from Marcus Consolini, who is the CEO over there. And we connected, and within, I think, a week and a half, 2 weeks, I was on a flight to Osaka.
Oh, wow.
it was unbelievable. And they welcomed me with such open arms. Daimon San is one of the kindest, most generous men. He opened his brewery to me, Marcus as well, their home, welcomed me and helped me to really learn a lot when I was there and participate. You know, I got to be in their koji room. I got to help wash the rice and steam the rice and clean the press and do all the things that are part of that process. So invaluable experience, and one of the just it's been wonderful, and they've just been such great friends to me.
Right. So listeners, if you were wondering what this magical Marcos Consolini is, and he joined us on episode 214, and he's the only non-Japanese sake brewery owner, I mean traditional brewery owner, and his story is really magical too. So that's on episode 214. And wow, so you completely got the hands-on experience and taught by the sixth generation master. So it's such a destiny, I think, sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like sake kind of came into my life and took over in a way, you know, from that trip to Japan to learning about it to making it at home to kind of these bigger steps. It kind of just came in and took over. It's and I love it. I absolutely love it.
Right. So, but, you know, opening a sake brewery is not easy, particularly outside of Japan. So what are the biggest challenges so far?
Oh, there have been so many challenges. Yeah, opening a sake brewery is not easy to do. From a legal standpoint, you know, we are Virginia's first and only sake brewery. And so it was a question of how would we be classified. You know, where would the law kind of put us, having never dealt with a sake brewery before? Trying to source equipment was a big challenge. And then, you know, sourcing rice, getting yeast, getting koji supplies, and building this place out and kind of, you know, having to explain to people what we're trying to accomplish in all the different processes to help build out the space. And then, yeah, getting it all the way to the point where we open the doors and, you know, trying to drive people in here and get them to understand, like, what we're actually doing. So on every level, it was challenging. And, you know, we put a lot of ourselves into it. Most of the bar itself is and tasting room was built by hand by myself and my father. And, you know, a lot of the equipment is kind of a hodgepodge, borrowing some things from beer, borrowing some things from wine, a lot of custom built pieces like our koji table and some of our koji boxes. So it's a constant work in progress of kind of building and keeping up what we've got. But I think even more than that, once we kind of got rolling, the biggest challenge has definitely been getting the word out about who we are and what we're doing. And, you know, we're 2 years in and we're still, we still hear all the time, I had no idea you guys even existed. But luckily the people who come here and try our product, you know, come away loving what we're doing. So it's just a challenge, you know, kind of getting the U.S. market to embrace what we're up to, but it's more about just getting our name out there, I think.
Right. You know, this COVID did really crazy bad things to us, but one of the upside is that the alcohol sales went up, like, I think by 80% or something. So, and I also heard sake sales, retail sales went up by a lot since the lockdown. So, sounds like there is some silver lining, I hope.
Yeah, I think there's some silver lining. You know, I think... it really depends on different markets. You know, we went through a lot of ups and down over the last year and continue to kind of go through that. A lot of our sales right now, being such a young sake brewery, is actually through our tasting room. You know, we spent a lot of time building a tasting room that was welcoming and that where people could learn a lot about sake. So we offer flights. We offer brewery tours. You know, our koji room has windows right there so people can look in from the bar. And, you know, we wanted to create an experience for people. Well, and, you know, obviously with COVID, a lot of restaurants closed and we were no exception. So there's periods of time where we were closed. But we've eventually kind of were able to reopen and kind of build that back up again. And, you know, I see a lot of potential in the future. You know, it's been hard. You know, having to kind of scale back what we've been doing, or to have, you know, maybe lower revenues than we anticipated. But everyone who comes through these doors is just so excited about what we're doing, And we're excited to be expanding our distribution partnerships across Virginia. So there's a lot of silver lining out there. I feel like we kind of have to weather these last few months, fingers crossed, you know, between the COVID spikes. But we see the vaccine is rolling out and is positive on the horizon. So, yeah, we have some silver lining ahead of us.
Mm, yeah, and we're going to celebrate it with a lot of sake once everything's open. So let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll discuss Andrew's award-winning classic sake as well as mind-blowing creative sake. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Andrew Santofante, who is the co-owner and head brewer of North American Sake Brewery in Charlottesville, Virginia, which opened in 2018. And it is Virginia's first and only sake brewery. So what is your philosophy of sake making?
Yeah, so my philosophy on sake making is... put your heart into it and make the best sake that you can. You know, we're young, we're 2 years in, and you think about that compared to some of the lineages of sake breweries in Japan. we're barely a speck on the map. And, you know, we're also an American sake brewery, so, you know, we talked a little bit about some challenges, but there's just a heap of challenges, whether it's you know, the rice that's available or the equipment that we have versus maybe more refined Japanese equipment. And so I feel like these first 2 years have been spent vetting a lot of things. It's spent learning my equipment. It's been spent learning the rice that I have, learning my koji room, learning my own styles and you know, and brewing batch after batch to kind of keep iterating and to keep building and to keep improving. So I think we're very much in this early stage of constant improvement. You know, constantly tweaking, you know, soak times, constantly tweaking steaming times and fermentation temperatures, and how long we're, you know, maybe growing koji for and at what temperatures and all these things that are a little bit of wild cards for us because it's all kind of new. So I guess my philosophy is it's a mix of constant iteration and improvement right now, but also just knowing that if I try my hardest, if I put my heart into the sake that I'm making, that will show at the end of the day. One of you know, my favorite conversations I had with Diamond San when I was at Diamond Shuzo in Osaka was about this same thing, and talking about automated equipment in sake brewing and versus handmade things. So like, you know, automated koji makers versus handmade koji. And he said that he really believes that you can taste the difference, that hand touch, the passion, the heart that you put into making your koji, that you put into your sake, people can taste it. And I believe that. I really do. And so, you know, sake making is really hard. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy and It's physically difficult. It's more of a marathon, you know. And so, you know, I think you spend so much time doing these things, and that by putting your as much of yourself, as much as your heart, as much as your effort into making sure it's as good as it can be. And even though I know that we have a lot of room for improvement and we have a long, long journey ahead of us towards, you know, improving our sake, that, you know, everything we do is to make it as good as possible.
That's excellent. I think sake, Japanese sake, to me, it's a product, but it's more like craft, you know, because of the nature of the tradition. And I think that's what you said. And I can taste the difference too. You know, I kind of like some energy put into the product. That's what Japanese traditional sake is to me. So it sounds like you're doing it here in America. That's very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you know, it's just a lot of work. And I feel like, you know, we put so much work into it. I want people to taste that. I want people to know that it was made by hand. It just is the way it is.
So how do you call your style of sake?
Yeah, that's a great question. And honestly, I don't know the answer to it yet. Again, we're so young. Still learning so much about what our style might be. But I think that something I've always wanted for this brewery to do is to help people understand sake better, to make it approachable, to make it, you know, in line, and so that they can understand it, so that they can drink more of it and appreciate it more. And so what we have been really focusing on is trying to make our, you know, categoric sakes as good and as kind of close to what they technically might be. So we want our Junmai to be recognizable as a solid Junmai. Same with our Daiginjo or our kind of dry Karakuchi Genshu style. Like, we want that to be something that people can taste next to other sakes that we make and start to get a picture. Oh, okay, this one's dry. This one is a Daiginjo, so maybe it's a little bit more fruity and refined. This is a Junmai, kind of like a really great overall table kind of sake. And kind of help people walk them through and see the vision of, like, okay, it can be, you know, earthy. It can be fruity. It can be sweet. It can be dry. It can have a range of flavors. And I think by giving them that mental map, by having strong individual sakes that kind of exemplify these different categories, gives them the opportunity to learn their palate and understand what they actually like. So I don't know if that's a style more than just an objective, but that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, well, that's excellent, right? Because I don't know how many people who shop at the wine stores, they look at the label and it looks dark. Maybe it's more tannic or, like, you know, the funny label. It may be sweeter. It's just very subjective. You're just guessing. And by providing specific information, I think it's really, I think, the way to go from now on, especially because online sales are everywhere and you can add any information you want. And you can click away, you can purchase something you think, you know, you're certain that you want this. So, yeah, I really like the way you approach sake in this market, especially.
Yeah, I mean, it to me, it's just really important. We have an opportunity to, you know, help people understand what sake is and to help them fall in love with it. So, you know, any kind of information we can give them or kind of roadmaps to understanding, I think, are good. And that's why, you know, we focused so hard on this experience here in Charlottesville at our tasting room is because we know that people, once they taste our product, they love it. You know, once they understand what sake is and I can bring them into the brewery and show them the Koji room and show them, you know, the process behind it, they go, oh, wow, this is so much more than I thought it was. That little spark can, you know, set off, hopefully, a lifetime of sake. enjoyment. You know, that's, yeah. And I think that's how I fell in love with it, was someone, you know, helping me, you know, at that sushi place, kind of saying, try this one, you know, this one might be up your alley, and realizing, wow, there's a world here. There's a range of flavors. There's a range of style.
Right. So you mentioned a couple of times, you know, that it's hard to get ingredients and everything in this country, but how do you source your ingredients, such as rice, yeast, and what kind of rice, yeast, and maybe koji do you use in your own sake?
So, you know, there aren't as many, you know, rice suppliers in the U.S. as there are in Japan. There's kind of two main ones that we purchase from. And in terms of yeast, yeast is a tough one because there aren't a lot of sake-specific yeast available from, you know, your yeast banks here in the U.S. I got lucky, and another sake brewer gave me a slant of some yeast, some 901, and then I've been able to purchase a few from Japan. And then our koji spore comes from Japan as well, from a company there. And it's interesting, I think early on, especially in my basement sake brewery days, I was purchasing a lot of different types, as many different types of koji kin as I could, or different rice varieties that I could, or trying different yeasts. And while that's still on my roadmap to experiment with more with those, I've kind of toned it back and trying to now focus on, again, removing some of the variables so that I can refine and make our sake as good as it can with the kind of the ingredients that we can. And so we actually use all Cal Rose variety of rice right now. Not because I think Cal Rose is like a spectacular sake rice, but it's a very widely available rice here in the U.S. It's very affordable. And it gives me the opportunity to learn that rice. And so I'm really digging in and you know, every batch kind of adjusting small things about how we use that rice, whether it's soak times or fermentation temperatures, how the koji is growing on Cal Rose. So I'm learning it, and I think that that's important to spend the time to kind of learn with what we have.
Right. So for listeners who aren't familiar with sake rice, they're basically sake production-oriented rice that's specifically grown in Japan. And I spoke to many, I mean, you know, there's not too many sake brewers here in America, but I think at least a couple of them preferred using Cal Rose. And I think it's amazing that you don't have to stick with sake rice that's grown only in Japan, because this is such a terroir-driven product. So why don't you just use what you have here that was grown in nature in this country with the water and air? And I think it had been water. So, oh, by the way, the water in Virginia, is it good for sake making?
Yeah, it is. It's very good. We have a low iron content, a low manganese content. And it's not too hard. It's not very, it's like right in the middle. It's not particularly soft either. So we get a slightly more vigorous fermentation than maybe soft water might give. But I think it's pretty solid. And, you know, that's one of those things, I think, too, that it is kind of one of our pieces of terroir. So I don't mess too much with our water. It's kind of the water that we have. I guess that's a lot of my mentality, is it is what we have.
Right. Well, that makes me really curious about, you know, how your sake tastes like, because like Kato Sake Works in New York, for example, versus your, I think he uses Cal Rose too. And if you compare the two, what's the difference, right? I mean, of course, it's koji, but water must be really a big element to affect the taste. So I'm just really curious. Yeah. So so you make both classic and creative sake. So first of all, what types of classic sake do you produce? And by the way, you won silver and gold a bronze medal for your classic style of sake. So it must be really good.
Thank you. Yeah. So our real magic is our Junmai sake, made from cow rose at 70% with a 901 yeast. And we won a silver medal for that at the Sake World Tasting Challenge. And I'm really proud of that one. I think one, you know, a style like Junmai, which is just I love Junmais. They have that, they have a little bit of everything, even though they're not kind of regarded like Daiginjos might be. And I think too that we've been working on our Junmai, you know, since we've opened, and I've again just been iterating on it and trying to make it better and better. So it really is a proud thing for me to be able to say, okay, we actually got some recognition for this one that we've been working on. And you know, we'll keep working on that. And then we won a bronze medal for our Serenity Now, which is a Junmai Daiginjo. Again, a cow rose milled to 50%. And this time we used the number 5 from Makita Kona yeast. And it has a really, really nice kind of almost tangerine quality to it with a really, really refined palate. And you know, just again, so happy to see the results of that, and you know, trying to make a style that's kind of indicative, so slightly fruitier character with more, you know, nose to it, more aromatics, and really happy with how it turned out. So those are our kind of two big flagships. We also make a Nigori style cloudy sake called Big Baby. And what I do, which I think, again, is to help people navigate this, is that our real magic and our big baby, you know, the Junmai I just mentioned and the Nigori, are usually from the exact same batch. And that's so that people can taste them side by side and get an idea of, okay, by leaving the ricin, by giving it that cloudy, hazy character, what does that do, you know? How does that change the flavor? And it's fun to see people try them side by side, and you'll hear them, oh, I'm getting notes of banana, and you know, the texture is there, and there's more kind of like robust flavor on this one. Oh, but the real magic is more subdued and mellow, and more a little bit more apple and pear. And so, you know, it is, it's amazing to see how much, you know, leaving those rice particles in there will do to affect the flavor. And even more so when you get the opportunity to say, these were from the same exact batch, you know, but this one has that rice, so it tastes different. I think that's a really fun opportunity to give people to, again, wrap their minds around what is sake.
Right. Especially Nigori, it's coarsely filtered, meaning there's still like live elements there, or like... And the muscadet is only like, you know, that yeast is still there. Like there's some elements of life remaining that gives a different flavors into sake, right? And I really like that romantic idea of some life elements in the bottle,
yeah,
too.
Well, you know, that's why we call it Big Baby. Because we'll do our kind of initial pressing, and then we will... basically, I try to bottle it either the next day if I can after pressing. So it's kind of this really early moment of sake for us, and it has this kind of vibrancy and brightness to it, which I think, like you said, it's kind of like this life to it, which I love. So it's the big baby.
And well, I can't help reading this. This is from... The 2020 World Sake Challenge website, and the description, that's the Junmai. Well, the Junmai, compared to Junmai Daiginjo, it's more like the ingredients of rice grains are not so milled down, meaning the original rice flavor is more potent. And the description is the silvery straw color, aromas and flavors of gooseberry, grapefruit peel, fresh-cut grass, buttered toast, and green bell pepper, with a sunny, crisp, fruity, light body, and warming, interesting, medium-length finish. Who does not want to drink it, right?
So, and, yeah, so the, sounds good.
Yeah, so that's the silver, and the bronze medal, that's the Junmai Daiginjo. And silver is true color, aromas of flavors of golden apple, tangerine, toasted oats, and frosted rice cake with a supple, lively, dryish, light body, and even brisk finish. So, and its price is really reasonable. So the Junmai is $18 and the Daiginjo is $19, according to your website, I guess. So, yeah, it's a...
Oh, yeah, I think it's... So the issue is it's two different sizes. So we used to do 750s. The Real Magic is $14.99 for the 375, and the Serenity now is $19.99 for the 375.
Right, so that's the price of like a half a bottle. Or mm-hmm. wine size, right? Basically. Okay. Yep. And so your classic style sake, of course, is very well recognized already. But you also have a very creative line of products that are made by infusing other ingredients. So what is the idea behind it?
Yeah, so I think we've been talking mostly about traditional styles, and you know, we're working hard to make those as good as possible. And then we... obviously, we live in the USA, where craft alcohol right now is having a really insane moment of experimentation and collaboration and kind of pushing the limits on fermentation. And so we are kind of taking up that torch as well and seeing how sake kind of fits into that picture. And so we do a number of experimental styles of sake, as well as fruited and infused sakes. And it really comes down to what I think is this melding of flavor, and that, you know, sake is very versatile in its palate, and that you can have something fruity, and that it can meld with other fruit flavors really, really well. And so we make a line of infused sakes that are, you know, slightly lower in ABV and maybe a little bit sweeter, but, you know, taking fresh fruit, herbs, spices, and adding them to the mash itself and letting it ferment kind of all together to create kind of wild and different flavors. And so we've done a number of different infusions. Kind of our mainstays are our lemon and mint infusion and our kind of fruit punch infusion. But we've done things like pineapple and sage. We've done... you know, mixes with more seasonal ingredients like pawpaw. We did a pawpaw sake, and pawpaw is a really native Virginia fruit that has this kind of mango-esque character to it. And so it's a little bit about seasonality and finding different fruits that are and herbs that are kind of indicative of what's happening in the season. And those come out, they're fantastic, and the sky is really the limit on fun things that we can add in that way. And then we do experimentation with other kind of forms of fermentation, whether that's doing something like dry hopping a sake, so taking some hops and adding it to it. And we did that, and the results were really, really amazing. And then we do other things like we are releasing our Moon Leap this week, which is our sparkling sake, but the way that I make it is it's a shubo only sake. So basically, you know, the shubo or the moto is kind of a yeast starter, and it's a small amount of the mash that you then kind of build upon to make a large batch of sake. So what we do is we actually make a little bit larger shubo, and then I just let that ferment all the way through for about 30 days, and it gives this a very high acidity content, and it has a really wonderful kind of starfruit-like flavor, and we get that carbonated up, and we bottle it, and it's really, really fantastic. So yeah, it's kind of like, you know, both sides of it, of kind of seeing what we can do with the fermentation to play with it.
But you said, for example, you have a sweet agni and sake infused with lemon and mint. So when you put the ingredients, with, you know, acidity and sugar and some herbal chemicals, right? So this in the mesh, how's the other, like, koji and yeast, do they react differently than without them?
Yeah, it definitely changes things. And that's part of the experimentation, is trying to figure out how it does. And it's a very, you know, inexact science at the moment, where, you know, usually I'm doing it kind of in late stage fermentation, so that it some of the character doesn't just get totally, you know, fermented out by the end of that full 30 days. And so, yeah, it is a lot of just trying it out and seeing what it does to the mash. And but in general, the results are just fantastic. The yeast is strong in sake, and it can do a lot of amazing things. So we're excited to keep kind of pushing the limits on that.
Sounds fun. You can't wait to try new things every morning when we wake up, right?
Yeah, well, you got to come down and check us out.
I mean, love that.
That's what it's all about, I think, is, you know, it's a mix of, it's kind of knowing who we are and knowing a little bit about what sake is and where it comes from. And so we kind of are tackling it on both sides, where we want to make really great traditional styles. We want to show our appreciation and our respect for the lineage that came before us and the masters that have done so much to bring sake to what it is today. And we want to make sure that we're doing our best to reflect that. But then we're, you know, like I said, we're in America, so we're going to have fun with American styles. And at the end of the day, if I can make something that somebody tries and goes, huh, maybe I do like sake, maybe I don't understand what this is, and pull them into the fold, then that's a great thing for everybody. That's
right.
that's exactly
what happened with the Californian rolls, like creative sushi rolls, right? Now, that's the beginning, and people got interested in sake, added the sushi, and there you are, people paying authentic sushi, like $300 per person. They don't mind because they appreciate the authentic style. Wasn't you use that sushi?
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, but I think really this American creativity, I think it's really important for any tradition, because you review. So what is the essence of the original product, right? And you have a huge respect to it. And why not try something new? Because that's how the tradition expands and make progress. So I think, yeah, what are you doing is just, I really think it's important.
And I think, yeah, I mean, I think that that's all part of it, is kind of pushing in these different directions and trying things that are new. And then, you know, maybe reviving things that are old. You know, I've still got things on my list that I need to tackle. Like, I have not done a Kimoto yet, and I really want to, and I just haven't gotten to it on my list. But, you know, there are some of those, like, you know, styles that are so incredible that I want to explore. The world of sake is just so rich.
Right. Yeah, but listeners, we're not familiar with the Kimoto. Kimoto is the more traditional, painstaking, very slow process, but you got a lot of good flavors of, you know, the natural ingredients like yeast. So, yeah. So, well, let me know when you do that. I'm very curious when you do Kimoto. Yeah, by the way, so you serve as chairman of the North American Sake Association. So could you tell us about the association?
Yeah, so I'm really proud to be chairman of the Sake Brewers Association of North America. We are a relatively new nonprofit that has the goal of growing the sake industry in North America. And it really was birthed from my experiencing in trying to open a sake brewery, you know, searching for resources, trying to source ingredients, trying to find equipment, trying to build a community and meet other sake brewers. It was all just, it was so difficult. And I just thought, this is something that will benefit everyone. I'm a big fan, a big supporter of the idea that a rising tide raises all ships. And so if, you know, if we can all as sake brewers in North America do better, then that helps everybody's business. And if somebody comes to my brewery and falls in love with sake, then they might go up to New York, or they might go to, you know, Asheville, North Carolina, or Tennessee, and try these other American sake breweries. And so, you know, it was just a missing piece. And I think the reality is we're so young in this, you know, 20 or so sake breweries with some more coming. That's nothing compared to beer, craft breweries, and wineries. And so if we plant the seeds now, if we start kind of building a community, you know, pooling resources, finding connections, you know, building relationships with Japanese breweries, building relationships with each other, you know, it's all going to pay in dividends in years to come when, you know, like right now, where do you get your yeast? Well, becomes, oh yeah, of course. Look at this brand new yeast that's widely available for everybody. Like, that's how you grow an industry. And so I think that that's the goal of the Sake Brewers Association. And it's a cool, exciting time for that too, because we're gaining new members all the time. And we are, you know, getting emails from people who are saying, hey, I've really been thinking about starting a sake brewery. You know, who can I talk to? And that's just the best, you know, because you can see it starting to grow. And then, you know, hopefully there'll be more and more sake breweries, you know, and then this idea of jizake, like, will become something here in the U.S. too.
Right. Yeah, basically you share knowledge of consumer development, brewery development, and also, you know, legislative reform. Like all those three purposes, which I think is really important to, you know, like you said, like bigger the pie, the better. And also you might want to go to Japan as a group. And then I'm sure Japanese sake producers get inspired by, oh, wow, this tradition is really springing forward to this new form, and it's very inspiring, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what the industry needs to grow, and it's what I need. Like as a sake brewer in the U.S., I need community. I need to be able to call up a friend and say, "Hey, this is happening. What do you think?" or where did you get that yeast? Or where did you? How long are you soaking your cowroes for? You know. It's things like that, that when you don't have it, you feel so alone, like you're on this, you know, desert island.
Right.
So if we can build community, that's great. And then, yeah, like legislatively, it's a big deal too, because sake is a little bit all over the map right now in terms of law and how it's treated state by state. You know, federally, sake is considered that it's manufactured like a beer, but labeled like a wine. And then state by state, some sake breweries are beer under the beer laws. Some sake breweries are taxed like wine. There are a lot of labeling issues that people are running into because of just a lack of understanding of what the product is. And so it's a challenge to try to navigate that, especially, you know, if you're a new business and a new brewery and you're trying to get started and you've kind of got these huge walls and you have no idea where to turn. Hopefully we can build a space that people can come to and grow. So that's kind of the big vision for it. Cause I think that, I think we're ready. I mean, I think the U.S. is a growing market, really strong growth, really strong adoption. Let's build it. Let's make this industry huge. Let's make sake awesome.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense, because I think Japanese food like sushi and ramen became a part of American food. So why not, I think. Okay, so what are your plans?
The future. I don't know. You know, the future is interesting. This last year really threw us for a loop, and it's kind of felt a little bit like we're just kind of holding on and navigating through what we can, but I feel like now that we're coming out of it, there's just a lot of potential to just keep pushing on our growth. I mean, what I see is expanding outside of Virginia, is a major goal of mine. I want to get up to DC and to a few other key areas and kind of grow our footprint. I want to create more styles of sake, some of those experimental ones, some of the more traditional styles as well. You know, the sky is the limit on this thing, really. And, you know, I hope that we can grow as our brewery grows. I hope to see sake grow. And I think that it will. You know, I really believe that it's the most beautiful drink on the planet. And I can't wait for more and more people to have that experience of finding that out.
Hey. I love that, the most beautiful drink in the planet. so, yeah, and then, you know, the sparkling sake is now very popular in Japan, too, because it was inspired by how popular it is in the American market. So, yeah, I think you are really pushing the envelope, and I can't keep my eyes off what you're going to do. So keep me posted.
Yeah, yeah. And you guys can, you know, check out what we're doing on our Facebook and Instagram, our website, www.pourme1.com. And that's also where you can purchase sake to be shipped to your door. So check us out, follow us. And, you know, if this is okay, I'll throw this out there too. If it's not, it's fine too. But I'm happy to give, you know, all the listeners of Japan Eats a promo code that they can buy sake and get a little bit of a discount. So if you put in promo code Japan Eats, you will get 15% off your order.
Wow. Thank you. Awesome. Listeners, did you hear that? The pourme1.com. I love the website's name, by the way. And then so promo code Japan Eats. So, wow. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For your and thank you for joining us today, Andrew.
Yeah, I'm so happy to speak with you. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, so let's try to do some number two for your progress sometime. I don't know, maybe next year.
Yeah, happy to come back. This was great.
All right, awesome. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneats@theheritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. Japan Eats is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Amanda Wong, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.